here, Your Majesty, we have an infant phenomenon. A remarkable child of 10. He's quite a historian, editor of our school magazine.
Ah, very interesting.
This, Your Majesty, is Rupert, our young editor.
How do you do, Rupert?
How do you do?
Sit down. And what's that you're reading?
Karl Marx.
Surely you're not a communist.
Do I have to be a communist to read Karl Marx?
Rupert.
That's a valid answer. Well, if you're not a communist, what are you?
Nothing.
Nothing?
I dislike all forms of government.
But somebody must rule.
And I don't like the word rule.
Well, if we don't like the word rule, let's call it leadership.
Leadership in government is political power, and political power is an official form of antagonizing the people.
What magazine did you say he edits?
A commentary on current events.
Pardon me. But, my dear young man, politics are necessary.
Politics are rules imposed upon the people.
In this country, rules are not imposed. They are the wish of all free citizens.
Travel around a bit, then you'll see how free they are.
Yes, but you didn't let me finish.
They have every man in a straitjacket. And without a passport, he can't move a toe.
But if you'll allow me to...
In a free world, they violate the natural rights of every citizen.
But you don't let me fully...
They have become the weapons of political despots.
Yes, but may
I... And if you don't think as they think, you're deprived of your passport.
Will you allow me
to... leave a country is like breaking out of jail.
Yes,
and
but...
to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
But
am I free to travel?
Of course you're free to travel.
Only with a passport.
Will you allow me to say something?
Only with a passport. Do animals need passports?
Have you finished?
It's in Congress that in this atomic age of speed, we are shut in and shut off by passport.
If you'll shut up and let somebody else talk...
And free speech, does that exist?
No, you've got it all.
And free enterprise.
We were talking of passports.
Today, it's all monopoly.
All right. Now, will you...
Can I go into the automobile business and compete with the other trucks?
If I can get in a word...
Not a chance. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores?
Will you shut up?
Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise. As I look back 60 years ago...
Where were you 60 years ago?
He was a grip in his great-grandfather's eye.
Very well, now. Have you finished? Now, let me say something. Let me tell you how wrong you are. In the first place... In the first place... Now I've forgotten what I wanted to say.
And the atomic bomb.
Ah.
It's a crime that when the world cries for atomic energy...
Bravo.
You want to make atomic bombs.
Me? I'm against atomic bombs.
You want to wipe out civilization. Destroy all life on this planet. You don't think you're living in the night.
I lost my tongue because I didn't want atomic bombs.
You and your kind think that atomic bombs can solve your problem.
Listen, you little rat.
Today, man has too much power. The Roman Empire collapsed with the assassination of Caesar. And why?
If you...
Because of too much power. Feudalism blew up with the French Revolution. And why?
All right.
Because of too much power. And today, the whole world will blow up. And why?
Because of too much power.
The monopoly of power is a menace to freedom. It degrades and victimizes every individual. And where is the individual?
I don't know.
Lost in terror because you've made to hate instead of love. If civilization is to survive, we must combat power until the dignity and peace of man are restored.
Well, that's from a movie entitled The Anarchist Kid, which Charlie Chaplin was in that movie. He's the one talking to the kid. Of course, Charlie Chaplin was a leftist. Some would say even a Marxist, but I certainly agree with much of what he said. And I agree with almost everything the kid said. And I think that he's closer to the mark than most people. A political parties, that's for sure. This is Yeah, I like that that delivery. That was great. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a rainy day. It's rains sometimes and then it quits and then it rains again. But that's okay. We can always use the rain. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And for the time being, we're going to forget about PayPal and all these programs like that. We're just going to stick to cash, check, or money order. Because we, that should be enough. Anybody can reach us that way. I understand somebody was going to send us a Western Union message, and that's okay. But we don't really have to have PayPal. There's too much snooping going on with PayPal and these other outfits. So let's stick to cash, check, or money order for the foreseeable future. Well, we got a bulletin in here from Stray Dog out there in New Jersey. Whatever happened to that governor that was going to win, going to become the president? I don't think he didn't get too far, that guy. Hi, T.T. Good to have you back and hear your voice on the radio show. Uncle Sam has decided to put a untouchable woman on the front of our $20 bill. And in protest, I intend never to possess ever again a $20 bill with some burrhead nigger on it. I don't care if she has blue eyes. That's the kicker. Tubman is a race-mixed burr-headed nigger mama. Get used to getting two tens, my friend. Politics. Big Tony poised to get the GOP nomination. See how he follows the Trump everywhere? Could be. I don't know. I love watching Trump. It's like watching my father. People are drawn to a dominant white male figure. Trump is mesmerizing. When Trump speaks in New Germany, we will have the inside scoop on the events. Well, there you go, Stray Dog. Keep us informed. Although the Third Reich famously suppressed what it labeled degenerate art, it gave a fair amount of leeway to actors, architects, artists, musicians, and filmmakers. That was providing they had no Jewish ancestry, weren't socialists, or... that's sort of funny since it was National Socialism, but I guess they recognized that it wasn't real National Socialism, anyhow, and were willing to keep any questionable political opinions to themselves. In a new book, Jonathan Petropoulos explores the careers of such artists and the moral compromise they'd made. Mark Falkoff writes in his review, "The National Socialists welcomed the accommodation of these artists because they had settled on no hard and fast aesthetic of their own. From the late 20s, the National Socialist Party ideologist Alfred Rosenberg attempted to separate good and bad art through his fighting League for German Culture, calling for a kind of blood and soil folkism, folklorism in the plastic arts and literature. But his efforts came largely to naught, partly because while the National Socialists knew what they didn't like, they weren't so certain about what they did. Even Expressionism and quintessential art form of the Weimar Republic was not ruled out on the bounds during the National Socialist period. Joseph Goebbels, control of the German culture, operated through a series of chambers, literature, film, music, and so on, and also through pre-existing academies, which he immediately purged of Jews and leftists. But a surprising number of creative people looked past this detail and were happy to work with a regime that, unlike its predecessor, was generous with funding for the arts. The poet Gottfried Benn, a modernist, served for a time as the head of the Prussian Academy. Moreover, as Petropoulos writes, quote, among non-Jewish writers, a relatively large number with stronger than average talent were accepted by the regime. Are you interested in how the U.S. investment in Israel paid off? Well, how about this? While the America-Israel relationship began as one of the great power extending hands to a vulnerable fledgling state, it has grown, in the words of Yoram Edinger, into an exceptionally productive, mutual, beneficial alliance. Now listen to this, he explains. Israel has been the most cost-effective, battle-tested laboratory of U.S. defense industries and the most reliable and practical beachhead and outpost of the U.S. defense forces, sharing with the U.S. unique intelligence, battle experience, and battle tactics. Yeah, see? All that war shit. The plant manager of Fort Worth-based General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, and there's one of the most corrupt corporations in the country, Lockheed, and they've been corrupt since way before even the First World War, which manufactures the F-16, asserted that the Israeli lessons have spared the manufacturer 10 to 20 years of research and development, leading to over 700 modifications in the current generation of the F-16, valued at a mega-billion-dollar bonanza to the manufacturer. See. Yeah, Israel's loves to get in there and make all that money on weapons. According to George Keegan, a former U.S. Air Force intelligence chief, the value of the intelligence shared by Israel with the U.S. exposing the air capabilities of adversaries, their new military systems, electronics, and jamming devices could not be procured with five CIAs. Israel, a special strategic partner of the USA and not a member of the Foreign Aid Club of Supplicants, increasingly contributed to mutual benefit joint ventures. There you go. There you go. All tied to the arms trade. War, war, war. Weapons, weapons, weapons. Well, this was in the Post. It's just a sign of the times. The headline is, "My wife and I are white evangelicals. Here's why we chose to give birth to black triplets." Yeah, it shows a picture of them. Two nice white Aryan people. Not Aryan because they don't follow the practice of race. But as I have made the stroll from my wife's hospital room to the NICU these past few days, it's been hard to fathom the way our family has been put together. This past Sunday, my gorgeous white wife, a white evangelical like me, a good Christian, gave birth to our beautiful African-American nigger untouchable triplet daughters whom we adopted as embryos. Now here's the two white people who have, by choice, chose to have cold stone black kids. These sweet girls will hopefully soon be coming home to meet their 3-year-old African-American brother and 2-year-old biracial sister. Both of them, see, that's five. Both of them we adopted as infants. The normalcy of this paragraph is something I have come to take for granted. Yet what seems to us to be a logical outcome of being pro-life is still something that to others often needs explaining. You see about pro-life? No, we don't want pro-life. Yeah, they're certainly not pro-life about the troops going over to the Middle East. Yeah. We want those abortion mills, especially in the black community, running 24 hours a day. Here's how it works when a couple adopts through our Christian Embryo Bank. Oh, I grew up as a child of evangelical missionaries in Honduras, very aware of racial diversity because I was the blue-eyed, cotton-top white kid who stuck out like a sore thumb, but all the while felt deeply connected to the people there, even though we looked very different. My wife, on the other hand, grew up in the Delta of Mississippi, and it wasn't until she took a few trips to Haiti that the veil of racial prejudice was lifted from her eyes. Oh, isn't that nice? One of the central themes of Christianity is, after all, that God, through His Son, is calling people from every tongue, tribe, and nation. Grasping diversity will make the world stronger as we marvel at God's creative genius on display through His people's varying pigments, personalities and proficiencies. Our differences are a cause for celebration, not scorn. Yeah. When we were still dating, a common bond that drew us together was the fact that Rachel and I both wanted to adopt. While we were fertile, we were both deeply convicted that one of the ways to be pro-life is to involve ourselves in adoption. Several years into our marriage, even as we were pursuing the idea of returning to Honduras as missionaries of the race-mixing Presbyterian Church in America, we visited an adoption agency in Mississippi where we were living at the time. We were also trying at the time to conceive naturally, knowingly that it is often more challenging to find adoptive homes in the United States for untouchable children. We informed the agency that we were willing to accept any child except a fully Caucasian child. You got that? We informed the agency that we were willing to accept any child except a fully white child. We did this from a deeply held conviction that if the Lord wanted us to have a fully white child, my wife would conceive naturally. We see protection of children not as a charity, but as part of a political agenda, but as something near to the heart of God. Because every human life bears His image, all life, no matter how young or old, no matter the stages of development, has inherited dignity and value. The scriptures testify that God has always pleaded for the protection of His most helpless and needy image bearers. Another prevalent theme of the Bible is that God adopts believers into His own family. When we adopt, we are echoing His own compassionate work, giving the world a glimpse of the truth and beauty of the gospel, where it says, obviously, you should adopt niggers. I mean, untouchables. When we began the adoption process, we knew race could play a major role in our family dynamics, which led us to ponder deeply what a racially diverse family would look like. We believed that when you look into any human's eyes, you're looking into the face and image bearer of God, into the eyes of a person whose soul is eternal. Well, that is the common thread of all humanity. It doesn't mean our racial differences are insignificant. We see the human family's varying physical characteristics as awesome reminders of God's creative brilliance. It's not that we think race doesn't exist or that we don't see it. In fact, it's the opposite. We see it and we embrace it. There is something beautiful and enriching being the only white face sitting and chatting with some of my African American friends as my son gets his hair cut on a Saturday morning. There's also something wonderful about the relationship that is built as my wife asks a black friend on Facebook how to care for our little biracial daughter's hair. The beauty of a multi-ethnic, multiracial family is found there, in the fact that the differences are the very thing that makes ours richer and fuller. It's so wonderful. It forces you to think in a new way about the way you think, speak, act, and live. But we knew, especially in the South, that a white couple with non-white children would draw a myriad of different reactions. Not enough. There will always be older white women in Walmart who stare at us with sheer disgust, or the African-American mother who looked at us just shook her head. However, there was also the young black girl who wept when we told her this little boy with her skin color was our son, and the older white doctor who lovingly prayed over him and held him so tenderly. These latter experiences were rays of hope, reminding us of how far our country has come, how far our country has drooped, while the former experiences reminded us of how far we still need to go. We've got to have more of this. It was our commitment to the protection of the unborn and to the idea of continuing to add to our family that led us last year to the National Embryo Donation Center, a Christian embryo bank. With our adopted children keeping us busy, we hadn't been exactly looking for anything to add to our already full plate. However, we had recently run into a couple who were highly encouraged us to look into embryo adoption. We were deeply moved by the idea of adding more children to our family by rescuing these tiny lives created from an in vitro fertilization, and intrigued by the thought of Rachel getting a new to experience of pregnancy. We live in a world with hundreds of thousands of embryos frozen in the United States alone. Most who aren't selected by their biological parents are donated to science or destroyed or kept frozen. If Christians or others really believe life begins at conception, it follows that we should respond by being willing to support embryo adoption and even take part in it ourselves. When we met with the NEDC, we were again faced with the question of what race we would choose for our adopted embryos. We wanted additional siblings to feel connected to the first two children racially, and asked the team at NEDC if we could be matched with Negroes embryos. They agreed with our thoughts about our kids matching each other racially and were supportive of the decision to select untouchable embryos. In September of last year, we had two embryo implants and began the long wait to see whether the transfer was successful. The day to visit the doctor could not come fast enough. 6 weeks after the transfer, we were made a very nervous trip to the local hospital in Honduras, where we were serving as full-time missionaries, spreading lies and bullshit. We began to describe everything to our doctor in Spanish. He asked us a few times if we were sure we had transferred two embryos. Yes, of course we were sure, we said. However, one of these embryos had split in two inside Rachel's womb. She was indeed pregnant, not only with twins, but triplets. Happy day. It's been heartening to see virtually all of our friends and family express overwhelming support for our family and the unusual ways we built it. In our minds, we are just living out our dream. A dream that may not look like the average family, but one that we are thankful could come true in light of our country's history. It's especially encouraging to see so many of our fellow millennial evangelicals now placing a high priority on life, adoption, and multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-nigger families. There you go. That's the state of the race. You think you're going to solve that very quickly without you can imagine. That's why I support chaos, the whole thing to collapse. That's the only way. I was watching a movie last night, which was a documentary, really, called Cartel Land. A great movie if you want to see ISIS in Mexico, because what the cartels are doing in Mexico is almost the same as, in most cases, the same as ISIS in the Middle East, as far as the way they operate. But I felt bad because a man that was heading up a sort of a vigilante group to drive these guys out of their towns down there in southern Mexico, I ended up the feds putting him in prison for having illegal guns. Well, the point is, he had cleaned up the cartels for quite a large area in southern Mexico. He's a hero, and he should be really respected, but the government shut him down. of course, they'll shut anybody down that tries. That's why you can't play around at the bottom with this kind of stuff. This stuff has to be revolutionary, and it must go on and on and build and get bigger and bigger. They made the mistake of handing these people over to the federal authorities, who, in most cases, slapped them on their hands and let them go. Unfortunately, they had, if you're going to wipe them out, you got to do them in. You got to kill them all. And, of course, then they started having problems with cartel people infiltrating this legitimate organization that was doing a lot of good work. And then some of the people that were already members of this group turned and took the money from the cartels, too. But there's no way of talking about taking these things on a bite at a time in small situations, because you're going to lose. It has to be a father-to-son revolutionary ethic that goes on and on and on until you either have victory or you're dead. You can't play in between. These people were well-meaning, and they were trying to play the game and even trying to cooperate with the government when the government is the heart of the problem. The Mexican government is the heart of the cartel problem. So I think you should see this documentary, Cartel Land, and see what I'm talking about. That's why militias and groups like that can't win. I mean, they have good ideas, and they have they're well-meaning, but they can't win because they don't go for the throat. I must say, Castro did, people like that, and like Mao Zedong. They seem to understand it. So anyhow, if you're thinking of taking on the government or even driving the bad organized crime people out of your community, forget it, unless you're prepared to go all the way to civil war and revolution. And then you may have a chance. Maybe. Here's a little bit of scuttlebutt I picked up on the late night radio about the KKK, and I'll tell you, yeah, I'm not even going to comment on it. Yep.
The earliest memory that I have of the cross, there was a black man, you know, there was a black man, you know. Earliest memory that I have of a cross burning would be there was a black man and a white woman that were married to each other, and they were living in our town. And so several of us went by and made a cross and went by and put it in their yard and set it on fire. Makes a cross, they wrap it in rags and soak it in kerosene. That's what you're, the way, so the correct way that they did it, then you set it on fire. That way it burns for quite a while before it goes out. Whenever the Klan would do something like that, you didn't stand around and watch it, watch the cross burn. You just put it on someone's lawn, light it on fire, and get gone, you know, because, I mean, if you get caught, you know, you're going to go to jail. You do it in the middle of the night, you do it in the dead of the night, you do it quickly, light it on fire, and gone. That's the way that the Klan did things back when I was a kid. Now, see, when the Klan burns a cross on someone's lawn, it's a little different from when they burn a cross at a rally. That is their symbol. And they stick around and do that when they're standing around in a circle, generally, and they light the cross. They say, "Behold the fiery cross, the oldest symbol of Christianity, signifies Jesus is the light of the world, and through him he removes all darkness, and hail the white race."
So what about electric crosses? It seems to me I found some information that the Klan also would use, especially for their own meetings, they would use electric crosses. Did you ever see anything like this?
Yeah, well, what the Klan done is if it's too cold outside, then they would come into someone's home or to a meeting hall, like a lodge hall or wherever they would have their meetings, and they would have a wooden cross that's erected on a stand, and it would have Christmas lights strung around it, like white Christmas lights strung around the cross all the way up and down, and you know, to cover the entire cross and plugged in, and they light it that way, and then prospective members must kneel at that cross, or they use it as a, if they're going to just do, even if they're not swearing in prospective members, they would have a cross lighted that way, and that's what some people would refer to as the electric cross.
But if you were a prospective member and you were ready to join, you know, this organization, that you were, you know, all excited to kneel down before the fiery cross, and you opened your eyes and you're just looking at a string of Christmas, you know, I could think that might be a little bit of a letdown, no?
The idea of someone joining the Klan is pretty sinister anyway, you know, the reason someone would join. I don't think that they would be too concerned with whether it's done with a cross that has Christmas lights stuck around it or the fiery cross out in the pasture somewhere, you know. I think that what's important to the Klan is getting someone to take the oath to join the Klan, because the oath of the Klan, what they call the naturalization ceremony, that's when someone goes from being a prospective member to a full-fledged member of the Klan.
What kind of cross did you get?
I had the one with the Christmas light stuck around it, and I was sworn in inside of a home by the Imperial Wizard himself. When I look back on any of that, I look at the whole symbol of it as a Christian now. I look back on it as a symbol of evil, as a symbol of Satan, you know, because it is a symbol where the cross sets mankind free, and when the cross is on fire, to me personally, it's evil because it is Satan trying to destroy what sets mankind free. I'm not going to insult your intelligence and tell you that when I gave my life to Christ, you know, I jumped up after saying one prayer. I jumped up and I said, man, I see the cross differently now. I see black people differently. They're my friends and I love them. They're my brothers and sisters. And I'm going to call up Cyndi Lauper and Michael Jackson and sing We Are the World with them, you know. That's not what happened, okay? I had to get my mind renewed. I still had prejudice. I still had racism. I still saw things different. I had to quit reading all of that junk that I've been reading all of my life. I had to burn my Klan robe. I had to get rid of all that Klan paraphernalia.
You burned it.
I sure did.
Really?
I burned my Klan robe. I burned my Klan robe. I burned Klan paraphernalia. I burned Klan books. I had Klan posters. I had Klan knickknacks. You know, you name it. I had a big. I built a bonfire and I threw all of that in there. I rebuked it off of my life and I said, I want this to be no part of my life whatsoever. My whole journey in life was all about the cross. I burned the cross, and now I've gone to preaching the cross. On my Twitter page is the cross of Christ with the Holy Spirit dove going and floating across the cross, and it's a symbol of Christianity, symbol of Jesus Christ and what Jesus did for me at Calvary, with the Holy Spirit dove coming across it, which is the spirit of peace.
Today, then, if you see a cross with Christmas lights on it, say, on someone's lawn at Christmas time or at the mall, does this bring back memories of your Klan days?
Sometimes it does. I'll be standing in church, and sometimes, you know, they'll be singing a hymnal, and there's a song that says, at the cross, where I first saw the light. You know, sometimes I'll hear them singing that, you know, and the memories come back, you know. And I know it shouldn't, I mean, because it's a good, clean beer song, and they're certainly not singing songs about the KKK. But you know, the whole idea when I sing a song at the cross where I first saw the light, I mean, of course I'm going to have some bad memories. It's going to pop back into my mind. But the thing to do is that that I just, when that happens, I just go on and I just pop it right. I do my best to pop it right out of my mind and concentrate on Jesus.
Well, I'm sure that most of you don't go back that far, but I heard this in the middle of the night, and I said, I think I know that voice, and that's the voice of Johnny Lee Clary. Johnny Lee Clary was from Oklahoma City, and he tried professional wrestling, started out at that. He didn't do too good. And then he got into used car salesman. He didn't do too good at that. Then he joined up with the Klan, and he thought the meal ticket was with the Klan. I met him in Oklahoma, and he was going to try to run for governor on my shirt tails. And it was funny as hell because he had no chance at that. But Johnny tried several things, and he was a fraud. Then he found the real magic twanger. He became a preacher, a minister, and a traveling minister. And he used to go down to Australia all the time, and for some reason he had an inn down there, and he'd go into all these little old Protestant churches in the back country and preach to them. And he made a pretty good living at that, I understand. But I also understand that Johnny Lee Clary has supposedly died a few years ago, so this tape has to be a few years old. And Johnny didn't realize, like a lot of other people don't realize, that cross is a pagan symbol, and it represents the cross of the zodiac. And if you don't know what the zodiac is, you better start studying, because that's what it is. Now, they did use a cross-like structure to execute people back in Roman times, but that's not the origins of the cross. The real cross of the pagan cross didn't have a bottom stand to, except to use it to stick it in the ground so it'd stand up. The real cross of the zodiac is a circle, just like the cross of the zodiac you see in magazines and books. And it has nothing to do with some guy becoming a Jesus and walking around the Middle East and doing all this nonsense that never happened. So Johnny, the joke's on Johnny. He was promoting a pagan symbol all the time he was preaching. Now, if you don't understand that, just look at a lot of these churches around, and you'll see a cross at the top with a circle on it. Well, that's the cross of the zodiac and a sign of the sun dying on the cross of the zodiac. And so Christians don't know it. They don't understand it at all. It's like most Christians today don't understand that the churches all over here in the Midwest that have a and that's the Masonic Tower, and it's the Jehovah's Witnesses use the Watchtower, which is Masonic, all Masonic. I'm sure that 90% of the Christians inside the church don't even have any idea what that watchtower represents. Well, since it's Friday, let's talk a little bit about Jesus, the man who never existed.
The story of Jesus, remembered history. Is the story of Jesus remembered history or a religious fable? When many of the other arguments for a historical Jesus fall over, you will often hear the argument, well, mainstream historians say there was a Jesus, so that must settle it. There must have been a Jesus. It is also the case that many atheists, though convinced that there's no God, will also say, well, I think there was a Jesus. So I want to take a few minutes to convince you that mainstream historians, and atheists possibly influenced by them, are actually wrong. Now let's first of all clarify just who it is we are talking about. We are not speaking of any old character of the first century Galilee who had the name Jesus. There were lots of those, literally thousands, because Yeshua or Yehoshua was one of the most common Jewish names of the time. We are speaking of a character who was supposedly the source and inspiration for the fantastical tales that fill the pages of the New Testament. Yes, I am allowing for the fact that embellishment and exaggeration could have been applied to an original, simple and genuine tale, that the man behind the legend may have been a rather ordinary character. But of course, it could not have been too ordinary, or he would not have stood out from the thousands of others who shared his name. Let me introduce you to one such figure, one favoured by mainstream historians such as Bar Ehrman and others. For them, the real Jesus was a prophet in the style of earlier Jewish prophets, who had a following for his particular brand of end-time doom and gloom. Because he was unexpectedly executed, his despairing followers reinvented him as a risen Messiah or Christ. All else in the New Testament is embellishment and invention. So here we have a rationalized, acceptable Jesus, who doesn't suspend the laws of the universe. But he is only one of hundreds of rationalized Jesuses. You may have a favourite of your own, a radical rabbi, a Jewish nationalist, a healer, a teacher, you name it. They are all equally valid and all equally speculative, floating free of any factual foundation. Now, why do I say these various alternative Jesuses are speculations? Because not one of them is based on hard, verifiable evidence from non-biblical sources. Any one of them is possibly true, but is any one of them even probably true? Each is derived from a selective reading of the gospel stories. Each is built up from certain passages, discounting all the rest as pious fabrication. That's why the so-called mainstream historians cut the ground from beneath each other. What is the pious fabrication to one is the residual element of a genuine historical episode to another. Yet not one part of the story is immune from being pious fiction to some and having the ring of truth to others. But there is an alternative to this free-for-all, join-the-dots-and-make-your-own-Jesus approach. And that is to recognise that these speculations are no better than seeing the signs of the zodiac in the night sky. In reality, there is no figure there, whether a sign of the zodiac or a Jesus of Nazareth. Now, Christianity makes a claim that a truly fabulous character started the movement with his teachings and miracles, climaxing in his resurrection appearances after death. But can rational minds really claim that some minor character below the visible event horizon of history was either necessary or useful to a story that is acknowledged to be, in all salient aspects, fabricated from religious literature? The simplest, parsimonious explanation is that no human Jesus ever existed. Now, although historians like Bar Ehrman think that it required the memory of a dead holy man to get the first Christians dreaming up a resurrected Messiah, in truth, merely the idea of a dead holy man works just as well. And we can be absolutely certain it was just the idea of a dead holy man, because the one thing we can say about the Gospels is that they were not written by simple, illiterate, Aramaic-speaking fishermen and peasants who knew Jesus, but were written decades later by literate, educated writers who wrote in Greek and were, incidentally, rather hazy about the Jewish landscape. We are not dealing with eyewitnesses. The gospel writers had either to be told the story or had to read their inspiration elsewhere. And what could they have read in the holy books of the Jews, translated into Greek centuries earlier? They would have read of healing and resurrection miracles, tales of food multiplication, of divine judgments, of wise prophets in special communication with God, who wander about making pleasing and sometimes enigmatic wisdom statements. They would have read of a suffering servant who takes on the sins of the world, of babies born by divine intervention. In other words, they would have read all the core elements in order to write an inspiring story of a Jewish saviour God-man, a Jesus Christ. All good stuff, of course, for a religious fable. But it isn't history. It isn't true. It's more astounding rubbish. Let's take a moment to consider a very important figure in the fable of Jesus, one who has had her own very illustrious career. I mean, of course, Mary, the mother of Jesus, the Blessed Virgin, quite a superstar in her own right. Now, the truth is, and anyone can check this, the scriptures have very little to say about the supposed mother of the supposed Jesus. Let's take a look at the first of the Gospels. The first to be written, that is, the Gospel of Mark. In Mark's Gospel, there is no divinely sponsored pregnancy, no pageant at Bethlehem performed by shepherds and wise men, no reference at all to Jesus' ancestry. The tale begins with a report about John the Baptist and features the baptism of Jesus as an adult. His family are nowhere in evidence when Jesus is tempted by Satan in the wilderness, or calls his disciples, performs his first exorcisms and healings, and starts preaching. In fact, the first reference to family isn't until chapter 3, when we're told that they think him mad. Well, he has, after all, started up his own cult and enraged the local Pharisees. When his unnamed mother and his brothers turn up to claim him, he rejects them, and like many a cult leader, tells his followers they are his family. Later, he raises the ante on that and says that each of his followers will get mothers and fathers a hundredfold. Mary, his purported mother, is referred to only once by name in Mark's Gospel, when the astonished locals in Nazareth can't believe his wisdom and identify him as a carpenter, the son of Mary. That is the only reference to her by name, and as far as Mark is concerned, Mary has no important role in the drama of Jesus at all. Matthew says a little bit more about Mary than does Mark. He introduces a prologue to his gospel that was unknown to Mark, the pretty nativity tale that entertains children. Now, Mary acquires a quality here that would have astonished the mother of several children that we read about in Mark's tale, virginity. She also acquires gold and precious gifts after the birth of her child from adoring wise men. And she is also fortunate to be having a husband who has very helpful dreams and communications from angels. It leads them to traipse first into Egypt and back again to Nazareth. Now, what makes it all the more surprising is that when Matthew gets to Mark's bit about the family thinking Jesus mad and coming to collect him, he leaves the whole narrative more or less word for word in place.
But you would think, with gifts from visiting wise men and prophetic warnings from angels in dreams, let alone the mass murder of infants supposedly by Herod, that Mary and Joseph by this stage would have realised their son was a tad special. Now, Luke has his own ideas about how to develop Mark's simple tale. For Mary, he introduces her to her first lines of dialogue, chatting with an angel and proclaiming how thrilled she is by the whole experience of birthing the Saviour of the world. But after returning to Nazareth with the baby, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is heard of no more in Luke's Gospel. And John's Gospel has precious little to say about Mary at all, although he does contribute two famous episodes, the one with Mary attending at the wedding in Cana, and has Mary standing at the cross for the grand finale. What is remarkable is not Mary's simple life as portrayed in the Gospels, but the extravagant development of that life in later centuries. Mary's own biography blossomed over the centuries, with early Christian writers like Justin elevating her as a second Eve, whose obedience reversed the sin of the original garden dweller. Artemis, the goddess of Ephesus, and Isis, the goddess from Egypt, became the templates for this new Super Mary. As a result, Mary became a perpetual virgin, and Jesus' brothers and sisters had to become his cousins. A second century fiction named Mary's parents and gave her an early career in the Jewish temple. In the 5th century, the church decided that Mary was not merely the mother of Jesus, but the mother of God, and thus she acquired the character of the Queen of Heaven. Mary's success is really quite extraordinary, with numerous saints' days, a chapel in every church in Christendom, and a worldwide following. Even today, Mary puts in an appearance everywhere that Catholicism launches a major marketing campaign. But it isn't truth, it isn't fact, it's just more astounding rubbish.
Well, let's close out the show this week with some more reading from Eugenics Manifesto. And our problems spring not from communist conspiracies, Jewish world plots, Illuminati, blacks, or Bilderbergers, but rather from the very institutions that the right-wing conservative patriots are trying so desperately to protect and defend. Conservatives would have us believe that we can save civilization by simply allowing resegregation of the more favored races and less favored races, or by returning to the ideas of fundamentalist religion, an ancient political dogma like the Declaration of Independence. Actually, we could run our government and our society today with the tenets of the Declaration of Independence and fundamentalist religion just about as easily as we could drive an 18th century carriage to the moon. The statement that all men are created equal is enshrined in our heart next to the E equals MC squared, when it should be cataloged next to break a mirror and get 7 years bad luck. Equality is man's most dangerous myth. All men do not have equal rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Only the ethical, moral, and law-abiding have a right to liberty. Only the productive and creative have a right to life. And only the wise have a right to pursuit of happiness. Democracy is a Ouija board theory of government. If a leading scientist was stumped with a problem and wanted to know the answer to a complicated question of mathematics, chemistry, or physics, would he take a poll of the opinions of those in the street? No. Why then would a government leader? governmental decision, somehow less critical to the progress of man and civilization than scientific ones. Or do the rabble have some innate sense of social problems that the scientist does not? Suppose you want to fly to the moon. Would you take a poll of the people in the street and ask them what components they thought would be necessary to incorporate a spaceship? If we did, what is the probability that we would ever get there? Why should the people in the street know more about politics than they do about aerodynamics? Why then do we ask the man on the street to vote on the components that he thinks are necessary to establish an efficient, workable, social, economic structure? For a politician to implore all the people to vote however they feel on election day is like asking a monkey to throw sand into the mechanism of Apollo 11 before it takes off. If we're to survive as a species, we must give rule to the few who think rather than to the many who merely fornicate. Numbers and fertility do not simply imply divine right to rule. We recognize that there are some people who should not be permitted to vote and interfere in the decisions that will determine the destiny of man, which is why we prohibit felons from voting. Perhaps we should extend that prohibition to include imbeciles and 10th generation welfare recipients. It would be a fatal error to think that our deeply flawed society could be saved by so simple an expedient as the mere segregation or expulsion of some troublesome national or ethnic group. Mindless slogans like white power. Now here I'm telling you, I told you there's some things in here you're not going to agree with, actually make it more difficult for us to understand the real philosophical and political dilemma of the 21st century. No matter what the racial makeup of the population, the tyranny of the lowest socio-biologic class in our Lysenkoist democratic political institutions will destroy us because our institutions give power to the most numerous and the least capable people who can simply vote the money and power away from the capable and competent working people. If this is allowed to continue, there will eventually be a dysgenics decline in population until the point is reached when the poor, incompetent, low IQ people on welfare or whatever race outnumber the superior socio-biological class of working people so much that they will no longer be able to maintain society or support the lower class. At that point, riots, mass starvation, and famine would reduce the population in an inhumane manner. Only eugenics, not segregation, would prevent this from happening. There's quite a bit of room here for debate, argument, but I think what he's saying is that all races need to be cleaned out, that all races can be improved, which I've said over and over. The totality of the white race is fallen through the cracks. I mean, they can't be saved, and through dysgenics, they've just gone beyond repair. And we have to understand that only with the culling out and saving of a certain group of people in the white race or the black race or brown race or yellow race or whatever is going to do any good. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. I think possibly Mother Nature is going to help solve it, but people can write about it and talk about it and all that kind of stuff, but I don't think it's going to happen. Even if we were an all-white country, and if we allowed this rot, dysgenics and things like that to continue, we'd still be collapsing. I mean, you take a look at the white people that surround you. It's pretty scary, man. The presence of more favored races and less favored races in our society can actually serve as a positive political advantage to the eugenic movement because it destroys the myth of equality and brings into question governments and political institutions based on that myth. So he's back on the track here, I think. The vast difference in the record of historical performance and autonomy between the more favored races and the less favored races is so dramatic that the real inequality of all men is dramatically demonstrated. The lesson one must draw from this is that if more favored races and less favored races are innately unequal, might not other groups and classes within the same race also be unequal? If the population were composed of only one race, it might be more difficult to demonstrate the political need to recognize the fact of inequality and to deal with this reality by implementing a genetic or a eugenics program. And that's what they tried to do in this country years ago. Years ago, and even the Germans borrowed it from us. But Margaret Sanger was in the forefront of this type of thinking to clean up the white race. She wasn't, I don't think she was concerned at all with the black race, but she was concerned with the white race, and she did believe in eugenics. If we all treat all people as though they were equal, the quality, ability, productivity of each succeeding generation will decline until we reach the point which we cannot maintain civilization at all. Expulsion of all the less favored races from America or Europe would not prevent this collapse, it would merely postpone it. Okay. The more members of the lower socio-biologic class and the less favored race that immigrate into the U.S. and Europe, the quicker and more dramatic will be the collapse of civilization, and therefore the greater the political pressure that could be funneled into the eugenics movement. If a conservative political group like the KKK were to expel the immigrants, that might prevent the rapid building up of political pressure that would be necessary to bring the eugenics movement to power. This would be a terrific victory because, in the end, civilization would still collapse because of dysgenic policies. Because of the presence of more favored races and less favored races in Europe and America, we have practically pre-written historical script to force the eugenics movement to power, because if we continue our present dysgenics immigration and welfare policies, our standard of living and our civilization itself must quickly decline and disappear. Consider the situation in Europe and America today. We have a population composed of a mixture of more favored races and less favored races, which are increasingly voting as a bloc within the political system, which dispenses power and resources based on counting the number of votes, and at the same time, the less favored races are increasing in numbers and their political power much faster than the more favored races. It is clear that such a society must theoretically destroy itself when the members of the lower socio-biologic class and the less favored races become so numerous that they can no longer be maintained. But at the same time, they cannot be thrown off within the context of the Lysenkoist democratic tyranny based on one man, one vote. Such a society must either destroy itself or develop a political system which gives power to the people based on ability rather than numbers. Only the eugenic movement can offer such a formula. If things continue on the present course, at some point, more favored races must either surrender their civilization, their standard of living, and everything that their ancestors built up over thousands of years, or break the political power of the less favored races and lower socio-biologic class. It is not a human psychology to allow this to happen. When people see their civilization and standard of living disappearing, they will be motivated to take action. Only the eugenics movement provides a meaningful, just, and practical means through which they can take action to preserve civilization and still treat everyone fairly without regard to race. if the eugenics movement is unable to prevent the coming dysgenic disaster, there are two possibilities for Europe and America. Either the political economic system will collapse and even civilization itself will disappear, or else the political system will be taken over by the working people of the superior socio-biologic class or more favored race by revolution or political activism. Well, forget political activism. That's out. Given human nature and frontier history of the U.S., the latter course seems much more likely despite the opposition of the media and the apparent quiescence of the middle class today. In either case, the human race... Wait a minute, let me see where we're at here. In either case, the human race is not saved from dysgenic decline, nor does any ultimate benefit accrue to our progeny in the long run, even if our population were as white as Hitler's behind. Our licentiousist political institutions would still destroy our society. Also, there would be an injustice committed, as well as the loss of efficiency, if a superior member of the less favored race, say a scientist, was expelled and a retarded member of a more favored race was retained. A eugenic society offers a system which each individual could be judged on the basis of individual merit. Obviously, new immigration would have to stop or be restricted to the best individuals. There would be no point in a eugenic society with open borders. If we implemented a universal eugenics program for the whole population, we would avoid racial war and avoid establishing a historical precedent of judging people by their physical appearance. Well, one thing that flies in the face of this is the German nation, at the time of World War II, were mainly all working together. They had the greatest science being developed and everything else, and they were basically one race. And so I think sometimes this writer may get a little bit too far away from basic genetics and like that. So anyhow, that's it for this week. I'll see you Monday. And this is Terrible Tommy, off and clear. Righto.
Your generals are bandits. Lord on the Catholic King of France. You employ any mercy you can get to lord on the Catholic King of Spain. And the court to play politics, as by a hundred other princes, kings, bishops.
All for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you. Religious fanatics who incite murder for the sake of a god they have never known. Don't you understand? There is no god.
Michael.
Probably the earliest memory that I have of a cross